and welcome to Achievement Oriented, Channel 33's gaming podcast. I am Ben Lindbergh, writer for The Ringer, and I am joined, as always, by my Ringer colleague, Jason Concepcion. Hey, Jason, happy 2017.
Oh, what a wonderful year.
Yeah,
I'm so excited.
Nothing catastrophic so far.
No, there's still time, but not yet.
Yeah, there's plenty of time. So how did you spend your holiday gaming hours?
Oh,
other than countless hours of Overwatch, I assume.
I did play a lot of Overwatch. I played a lot of Hitman.
Yeah.
Which I found quite enervating and also comical in various ways. It's just one of the best, probably one of the most entertaining stealth games just because of the amount of things you can do. And when you blow a mission, you can just go on a murder spree and stab everyone in the town.
Good. Yes. That's an essential quality of stealth games for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I use my holiday hours as kind of like a catch up for all of the holiday games that we talked about and maybe dabbled in or played enough to know what we were saying, but couldn't actually finish just because there was a new great game coming out every week. So I finished the Telltale Batman season. I started the new season of The Walking Dead, whose first couple chapters came out. And then I went back and played Infinite Warfare's campaign, which I had missed. It's really good. Really good.
Jon Snow up in this.
Yeah.
In space.
He was not the best part of it, but... Really good game by the, standards of a multiplayer shooter campaign. I enjoyed it. They took some risks, and I dabbled in Stardew, which you were...
Yes, tell me how you found it.
Well,
Ben.
I'm still in the stage where I am intimidated, because as soon as you start playing it, you realize that you could play it forever.
Forever.
Yeah,
forever. And ever. Forever and ever and ever.
So I sunk several hours into it, and I feel like I have barely scratched the surface, but I've harvested some crops, and I've gotten to know everyone in the town, and I have gotten my bearings a bit, so I'm looking forward to building out the farm.
Have you fished or checked out the mine?
I have fished. I have checked out the mine. I've only gotten a few levels in, but... Yeah, there's a ton to this game.
Have you gone to the community center yet?
I've not gone to that yet. I have many more hours ahead of me. I also spent some time catching up on Watch Dogs 2, which I played a chunk of for our podcast about it, but hadn't finished. And I went back and still really enjoying it. And that was timely and topical because later in this episode, we are going to talk to the guy who played the lead, Marcus Holloway, in Watch Dogs 2, Ruffin Prentice, and he happens to be the cousin of Justin Charity, another Ringer staffer who was on with us in the Final Fantasy episode. So we're going to talk to Ruffin and Justin, but before we get to that, we're going to do a little 2016 in review, 2017 in preview, talk about some of the trends that we've seen and will see sometime soon. So we are joined now by Simon Parkin. He is a contributing writer for The New Yorker and The Guardian and many other publications you have heard of. He also wrote a book, Death by Video Game, Danger, Pleasure, and Obsession on the Virtual Frontline, which came out in the US this past year and came out in England a year before that. I guess it took a year for the translation to remove all the Britishisms.
That's right, yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about the book? You kind of chronicled people who maybe have, in some cases, an unhealthy obsession with video games, in other cases, maybe a healthy one. Can you kind of go through a few of the examples, or if you've come across any favorite tales of obsession since the book came out, you could mention those too.
Yeah, so basically the idea behind the book came about when I had read one of these stories that comes out probably every few months, usually from Southeast Asia, Korea or Taiwan or China, where basically someone is found in an internet cafe after a day or two having been playing an online video game without a break, and they basically die in the cafe through lack of motion. These kind of stories get picked up by the tabloid press, certainly in the UK and probably in the US as well, as held up as an example of why video games are so bad for us and such a terrible pursuit for young people to take on, because not only do they rot our brains and distract us from meaningful pursuits, but also they wind up killing us in some cases. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to find out what was going on here, what were the reasons that people were dying, and you know, through their obsession. But really, I guess that's just a jumping off point in terms of my book, to then talk about all the other ways in which, you know, we dedicate our time and interest and to video games, and the interesting things that we do within them that come out of those acts of obsession. So, you know, while it's kind of sold as a, you know, story that's, I guess, in some way it's negative about the medium, in fact, it's really a celebration of what video games can be and do, and the incredible things that people do within them, mm-hmm. and what that appeal is, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Was there any specific example that stood out to you as something that maybe on the surface looks like it would be harmful, but is actually maybe a affirming or empowering experience?
I guess one of the most memorable stories is this guy from Chicago who calls himself Kurt J. Mack, and he wanted to launch a YouTube channel a few years ago and was trying to come up with a conceit of something that would be interesting for him to do. He decided to go into Minecraft, load up a game, and basically start walking in a single direction for as long as he could until he reached the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And in the version of Minecraft that he was playing at the time, the world was in fact finite. The current versions of Minecraft, they go on indefinitely. But the version that he was playing at that time did have an end point that he calculated it would take him about 20 years of walking to reach. And so he set up this YouTube channel and every week kind of films himself, every day even, films himself kind of walking for like half an hour, and just chatting about what's going on in the world to his viewers. And, you know, on this quest to reach, they're called the Farlands, and his YouTube channel is called Farlands or Bust. And I guess like on the surface, it's, you know, this ridiculous quest to, you know, meaningless quest almost, to dedicate so much time and effort and energy to just trying to see the edge of the Minecraft world. But there's something about it as well. It's where it's a very positive thing. It's become this platform for him to, you know, speak to, communicate with people about what's going on in the world, his takes, his life, share things that are going on in his life, and, you know, build a community around it. So, yeah.
I'm a big fan of your work in various publications, in New Yorker, The Guardian. You wrote a piece about the coming horror of virtual reality, which I found quite interesting. I'm not sure if you've seen the latest season of Black Mirror, the episode Playtest, in which basically someone is jacked mm-hmm. into a extremely realistic survival horror game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, various academics in recent months and years have talked about some of the dangers that could be associated with VR and extended stays in virtual reality. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the medium and its coming effect on our psyches?
Yeah, it's super interesting. I mean, it's such early days that we don't really know what those effects were going to be. I spoke to a designer last year. He's been experimenting, you know, making his own little games and demos. And when he first started playing with some of these demos, you know, he would say throw a car at the player. So you see this car hurtling towards you, and instinctively you move out the way of it because you know that if it hits you, you're going to be injured. But then after like a certain number of weeks playing this, your brain readjusts, and because it knows that in this case, if the car strikes you, there are no consequences. And so like in this way, this demo that he created was subtly altering a very useful instinct that he has to get out the way of very fast moving objects approaching him. And it was dulling that instinct for him. And I thought that was just quite an interesting, very small example of the way in which VR can, you know, slightly alter our brain in ways that are probably not that useful for our survival outside of the virtual reality domain. But yeah, like in the example of the horror games that I was writing about in that story, some horror game developers found that when a player was playing their game, if they were approached by a monster that was any larger than a dog, your brain goes into an authentic fight flight mode where you just think this thing's going to kill you. And it shifts from that kind of roller coaster sense of, well, this is perilous, but I know it's not real, so I'm enjoying the high of being scared while I've still got that subconscious knowledge that I'm not actually going to die in this situation. And it kind of steps over that line. So your brain is now, no, I really am in mortal danger. And so for them, they you know, introduced this policy in their designs that they wouldn't have any monsters approaching you that were larger than a certain, you know, size. And certainly for, you know, horror developers in VR, there's a kind of moral and ethical question for them to contend with, I think, in terms of, you know, jump scares and those kind of things, which when you experience them in VR are not that pleasurable because they just feel like jolts of adrenaline in the bad sense rather than in the video game sense.
And you wrote something at Nautilus just recently about how video games satisfy basic human needs and sort of the psychology of mm-hmm. why we play, not VR games specifically, but any games. And you kind of came up with some maybe counterintuitive reasons or not the first reasons that you would think. What needs or cravings did you find that mm-hmm. video games satisfy in us, whether we realize it or not?
Well, there's been some academic research in the last few years kind of looking into what is it about video games that we find so compelling when ultimately we're not really achieving anything in real terms, right? You might progress the story or whatever, but you're not, you know, if you spend 3 hours in a video game, you're not coming out of it with something tangible. And while I guess most of us would say we play video games because they're fun or it's a good way to unwind or something like that, what these researchers have found is that particularly in online RPGs and things like that, we get to try on these different identities, particularly for, I guess, teenagers and people in their early 20s, help people to test or try out identities that they might want to be in the real world. So you might choose to be a healer in a kind of magic RPG because you have a caring temperament or you want to see what that's like. Or you might choose to be the tank, which is the, you know, the class that takes all the damage from the monsters while the other kind of attackers can get on with it. And so, yeah, there's this kind of part of video games where you get to narrow the distance between who you are and who you want to be, that these academics have discovered, which is certainly quite interesting.
An interesting aspect of VR, I think, is going to be first-person shooters. Although I've seen some mixed results, people obviously dealing with nausea and things like that with a lot of the head movements. But I have a friend who demoed a game, and I don't know what the name of it was. But he said that after a certain amount of time, he started to feel really bad. And so just would shoot at the car because it was kind of like this on rails mm-hmm. shooter. And you've written extensively about first person shooters. I think the one that I found most interesting was from the perspective of this 18-year-old kid in the Middle East who plays Battlefield 3. Mm-hmm. How will virtual reality affect violent video games that really put you in the driver's seat of these kind of like explosively violent materials? Will developers react by making things less realistic, more realistic? At what point do things become too realistic?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, to demonstrate just how realistic VR combat situations can be, at USC, the University of Southern California, and there's a unit there that's been working for about 10 years with Vietnam veterans who are still suffering from PTSD, and more recently with Iraq veterans. And what they do is they interview the veteran and say, what was the incident in combat where that kind of triggered your PTSD now? What was the very traumatic thing that happened to you? And through this interview, they kind of take notes on what happened, the location it was, you know, say they were driving along in an armored vehicle and there was a roadside bomb or something like that. They find out, you know, how many people were in the vehicle, what else was happening on the road, what the street looked like, whether it was in a town or, you know, in a rural setting. And then they build in 3D, a 3D engine, they build a recreation of the exact scene and then put the veteran into that situation again so that they can kind of relive the trauma, but in a controlled environment. And it's a technique called exposure therapy that psychologists have been using with war veterans for a long time. But they found that in the case of virtual reality is so effective because they can bodily put people back into the incident again and then allow them to go through it in this controlled way. So I think that gives you a pretty good idea of quite how powerful the medium is in terms of the authenticity of these combat situations. And working back from that, you can see the responsibility that video game developers who are making first-person shooters for entertainment reasons need to, the caution they need to take in doing this kind of thing.
So you recently put out your best video games of 2016 list, the obligatory end of year exercise, although you went with the top 9 instead of a top 10. And it's a very diversified list in terms of genre and platform and length of the experience.
Richard Brody-esque, one would say.
Yeah, perhaps. You've got Last Guardian at number one. You've got No Man's Sky on there, despite the vehement backlash. So is there any kind of connecting line you can draw between some of these games or between the experiences that most appealed to you in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, lists are interesting, aren't they? I think in the last few years, video game end of year lists have changed dramatically. Even as like recent as 3 or 4 years ago, most of the video game sites would have very similar top 10 lists, and it would generally be the blockbuster titles that kind of all shared similar positions. And then really in the last 2 or 3 years, I think the lists have diversified a lot to reflect the fact that the video game industry is diversifying. And part of that is because the democratization of video game development. So it's now anyone that has a laptop or a computer and a web connection can download something like Game Maker or, you know, the free version of Unity and, you know, learn how to make their own game. And then they can put it out on the Apple App Store or on Steam or something like that. So, you know, in the last 5 years, we've just seen this explosion of new kinds of games coming out. And a lot of them are very rough and ready, and they might not, you know, they haven't been made by experienced developers. But what they do show is this diversity of experience. And whereas before that, we was, you know, video games were made generally by much larger teams. They were large financial risks for the people financing them. And that just led to this conservatism in terms of the types of games that we were getting. And they were very, very iterative along small lines. And you still kind of see that with the blockbuster games that are so expensive. But yeah, because we just had this explosion of creativity and new kinds of game come out. So that's made end of year lists more interesting, I think, in the last few years, because you can go to one site and get quite a different list to another one. For me, when I put these lists together, I like to champion games that are not it just iterating in small ways on ones that have come before. So, you know, while I think, say, FIFA 17 is a fantastic football game, or, you know, I might think, I don't know, the new Battlefield 1 is a load of fun as an online shooter, and they're not games to be held up for me as, like, in 10 years, I don't think people will be interested in FIFA 17 or Battlefield 1, because that year they'll have their new iterations of those games. Mm-hmm. So I'm never going to put those on a, you know, NewYorker.com end of year list, because you're kind of writing hopefully for the long term, right? You know, I want people to look back in 10 years at the games I picked and gone, oh yeah, that game did something really interesting that was novel and inventive and, you know, wasn't then just updated again the following year. So that's, I guess, one of my criteria. And probably another is just games that don't waste your time necessarily. And that seems a ridiculous thing to say about video games, which are, like, in essence, time wasters. But I think there are certain games that just pad out the experience, because there's an expectation with consumers that, you know, if I'm paying $60, I need this game to last 60 hours. So that puts pressure on the designers to pad it out with, you know, loads more encounters, or, you know, just stuff that doesn't need to be there. So I'm attracted to games as well that are short, I guess. But same. Also kind of lean as well, and yeah. And where, you know, for example, The Last Guardian, which was one of my favorite games of last year, is not a short game. That's a very substantial game, but it's not indulgent, I don't think. There's no, like, bits there. Everything that's in there is there for a reason and is working towards the final point. And that's not true of very many games at all that come out, where they you know, there's just loads of stuff that you're repeating over and over again without much consequence.
Trying to identify, you know, trends in video games is often a mug's game. Last year, it seemed like there was a story, mobile video games to be the biggest medium of video games. And then all of a sudden it was actually PC is now the biggest. And then it's, you look at the console charts at the end of the year and it's clear that, you know, that console's not going away anytime soon. But beyond that, if you were to look at, like, ahead at trends, whether it be design trends or business trends, what do you think is coming for video games in 2017, 2018?
There's definitely a business trend that is closely tied with hardware, in terms of, we saw Sony release PlayStation 4 Pro, which is kind of a supercharged PlayStation 4. And then Microsoft is doing the same this year with its Scorpio, which is a, I guess these are basically 4K enabled versions of their previous consoles. But that's definitely a new thing that we haven't seen. Obviously, PC owners have been upgrading their graphic cards, you know, every few years, ever since PCs have been around. And Nintendo has done it with its handhelds for the last 10 years or so. You know, we had the Nintendo DS and then all these different variations. And even before that with the Game Boy as well. But in terms of, yeah, those, the PlayStations and Xboxes, this idea that we've got a new load of televisions come out or virtual reality headsets are coming out. So we're going to release a stopgap machine that still runs all the same games that the people that own the older hardware can, but also gives some benefits for those who have invested in the latest supporting technologies. That's a new thing. And it will be interesting to see how that develops over the next, 5 years, whether they're doing this every 18 months or so, bringing out a new iteration that's not just smaller and cheaper, but is also in some way more powerful.
So we've talked about VR's dystopian future, and we've talked about hardware manufacturers making us spend much more money. Is there anything hopeful, optimistic, that you are particularly looking forward to, or just developments in 2016 that you found gratifying that we haven't touched on yet?
I think in 2016, we certainly saw some excellent Japanese games come out. And for the past kind of decade, it's been general wisdom that the Japanese industry, which was once the beating heart of the video game industry, has been in decline. And, you know, we saw The Last Guardian come out, then Final Fantasy 15 came out, a game that, you know, has its problems, definitely, but had been, you know, many people had just given up on it ever coming out. And then Super Mario Run, and we've got the new game Nier from Square Enix and Platinum Games coming out early this year. So that's gratifying to see, because I think the medium benefits when the Japanese side of the industry is in health. So hopefully that will continue. This year, we've got the Switch coming out, Nintendo Switch. Mm-hmm. And it's always interesting to see what Nintendo does. You know, there's that old maxim, never discount Nintendo, that pretty much every Western executive has said a version of over the years. And, you know, it remains true. And I think the company has had a rough few years and, you know, posted lots of losses. And then, you know, part of Super Mario Run coming to iPhones and Android phones is, you know, the company trying to reinvent itself, I guess, or find new ways to sell the things that it does that are magical to new people and new audiences. And we'll see what happens with the Switch as well, which I guess is brave in its own way.
All right. So you can find all of Simon's writing at simonparkin.com or on Twitter at Simon Parkin. And his book is called Death by Video Game: Danger, Pleasure, and Obsession on the Virtual Frontline. Simon, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks very much.
And we'll be right back with Ruffin Prentice from Watch Dogs 2. Today's episode of Achievement Oriented is brought to you by the Ringer MLB Show. I know that podcast. Every Monday during the winter and twice weekly during the baseball season, Michael Ballman and I break down baseball's biggest and sometimes silliest stories, mixing in interviews with other Ringer writers and media members and insiders from the front office down to the dugout. We've had players, we've had GMs, we've had a guy who plays a ballpark organ. So, like Achievement Oriented, it really runs the gamut. You can subscribe to the Ringer MLB Show on iTunes by going to itunes.com/theringer or finding it wherever you get podcasts. So we are joined now by Ruffin Prentice, who plays Marcus Holloway in Watch Dogs 2, and let the record show that I praised his performance in this game before we learned that he was related to the Ringer's Justin Charity, who has been on this podcast before and who rejoins us now for some family action. So hello, Justin, and hello, Ruffin.
Hey. Back, baby.
That's
which one of us is Marcus?
That's a good question, Justin. I'll be you. You be me, and let's get this thing going.
You've been trying to be me your whole life.
That's right. That's right, man. Just following in your footsteps.
I'm kidding.
This is a really good game, and you are really good in it. And I gather just from internet stalking you that you are a gamer, which is not the case of a lot of people who do voice acting for video games. We had Jennifer Hale on. She's one of the most prolific video game voice actors ever, and she's great. But I think she was doing it for a decade before she actually tried to play a game she was in. And it looks like you didn't waste any time popping in Watch Dogs 2 when you got the chance.
I'm not going to lie to you guys. Guys, I am like a reignited gamer.
Ah. Same.
This has thrown me back into the realm. But as Justin can attest, like, we grew up playing games all the time. So there was no way I was not going to play my own game. Like, that's something you dream of as a kid. And once it came out, I went to GameStop. I live in Manhattan. And went to the GameStop on, I think it's 86th Street and Broadway.
I know it well. I've been there many a time.
I think it's maybe the second biggest one. I went there for the signing and there were a couple fans there. The cool thing was my Uber driver, he sees me get into the car. This is on the way there. And he sees my shirt and he's like, "You're going to GameStop. What are you going there for?" And I was like, "For the release of the game." He was like, "Yeah, I see you got the Watch Dogs 2 shirt on. Any specific reason?" I was like, "Well, I play Marcus." And he kind of like turns back in the car and like is looking at me instead of the road. And I'm like, "Dude, hey, man, just get us there." And so like we get there. He's super excited. He's like, "Man, I'm not going to buy this thing until Wednesday because I'm waiting on a check to come through." And I'm like, "I totally get it." And sure enough, I thought he pulled away. I'm in there signing a few copies and he just comes in. He's like, "Man, I can't not get it with you here. I got to get it signed." So it was a pretty cool experience to see, you know, my Uber driver, like, "I'm pausing this money that I'm making and I'm coming in here to get this copy," which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Like in the game, you would have had so many options in that situation. You could have hacked the car and driven it yourself. You could have just gotten out and hijacked the thing. So you're really limited in real life, I guess, which is disappointing whenever I go from Watch Dogs to regular life and lose all the abilities that I have in that world. It is it's a humbling experience.
Yeah, I was thinking about calling a gang on him, but, you know, didn't really work out the way I thought it would. So
what kind of gamer were you? Justin was telling me that you guys back in the day would play Mortal Kombat, like in your first life as a gamer.
A lot of fighting. I played Star Fox a lot, too.
Ooh.
No.
Oh, and we played a lot of GoldenEye.
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, a lot of shooting each other. Justin and I shot each other a lot. We were shooting and fighting each other a lot.
It's very like biblical familial violence, man. It's very...
What were the go-to characters in your fighting games and in GoldenEye? Who'd you pick?
Mortal Kombat. I never like getting like the main character. Like I'd probably go with like, oh my gosh, now I'm blanking on his name.
No, you were always Scorpion. You were always like Scorpion and Sub-Zero. I swear that this is true. I remember this. You over here blanking. I remember.
I like Sub-Zero much more than Scorpion. But what's the guy's name with the blade for the hat?
He looks like a cowboy, but like a goth. I forgot who it is. The cowboy goth with the steel rim on his hat, and he'd throw it at people, and he had a goatee. It was very 90s.
Kung Lao.
Kung Lao, that's right.
Oh, Kung Lao, yeah.
Yeah. You know, what he had the blade on the hat, and he would throw the hat at it and cut you up. And then, you know, for the finish, him, he'd cut your head off.
Real.
Real.
That's it. Back it up. Send it home. And then GoldenEye. I mean, I like to just play as Bond.
Yeah. Looking good in the suit and everything.
Mm-hmm. Trevelyan was better. Trevelyan was better because he was slightly shorter. And that's like super important for that game.
Right.
Because you mess up people's sense of like how to aim. I'm telling you, man, Trevelyan, that was like the perfect character. Because he wasn't like Odd Job short, but he was short enough.
See, I always picked Odd Job. I don't care. People get mad about it because, you know, you can get the headshots, but he's the only Asian dude in there. I'm picking Odd Job. Yeah.
They weren't really having like the intersectionality debates.
No, they weren't doing that at that time. No, although Grace Jones in a video game, give it up.
That is true. Yeah,
props.
Give it up. OG.
Well, we'll get to that because that's something that Watch Dogs 2 does really well. But I want to ask how you got involved in this game, because just browsing your IMDb, you've been in a bunch of shows, just, you know, an episode here and there, Elementary and Power and Madam Secretary. And suddenly you are playing the lead in one of the biggest games of last year. So, and as far as I know, this is your first video game voice work. So How did this come about?
My agent called me. You know, video games are like, it's like top secret. It's like probably they go through the same protocol Obama has to do talking to Trump about UFOs.
Woo!
It's super secret.
Did you just compare yourself to Obama? All right. My man.
You know,
right.
I got high respect for the man. So, you know, I try to look at myself through the same lens.
Okay.
No, but it's so secretive, man. So like I got a script from my agent. She was like, it's this video game project. They want you to come in and read for it. And normally you just audition like in a booth, just doing voiceover stuff. But this was like they wanted to see you in person and see you act. So I was like, well, maybe this is some motion capture. So I got the script, and the script was completely random, secretive. The name of the character was, I think, maybe I'm not allowed to say it. I shouldn't say it. But the name wasn't Marcus Holloway. And so I had no clue what I was auditioning for. But I knew I really liked the material. I thought it was funny. I also consider myself, like I said, I'm a reignited gamer. But knowing it was in the game world, I was super excited to be auditioning for it. And so I went in, did it. This was just with the casting director. And then Ubisoft, two people from Ubisoft flew down to New York for the callback. And so I got to meet them and did the callback. And about a week later, they called and said, you got the role. And I was like, yeah, but what is it? And they still didn't tell me until I flew to Montreal for what they call your 3D facial scan. Once I was there, they like said, so this is Watch Dogs 2. You're playing Marcus Holloway. And they did the whole storyline. I had the writers and the creative director come in and just sit down with me and walk me through the entire game. From there, I was just, I don't know, I was geeked. I couldn't piece it together in my mind. I didn't understand the magnitude of what was about to happen. But it's been a great journey so far. Yeah.
Yeah. When we were talking with Jennifer Hale, she was saying that it's actually rare for them to tell you who you're playing, what the game is, what's going on. So they did tell you what game you were playing as soon as you got signed. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, I think they, as you know, Watch Dogs 1, the original,
yes,
had mixed reviews. I'll say that. And mixed reviews about the lead and how some people loved him, some people didn't. And so they really wanted to, this was something that they wanted to get right, because I think the second version of this game is the second Watch Dogs 2 is, it had a lot riding on it in terms of where the franchise could go. Similar to, I think, Assassin's Creed, where the second game really improved on what people felt the first game didn't. And so they really wanted me as the lead character. They wanted, one, the character to be likable. They wanted him to have personality. And so they really allowed me in on the creative end to contribute whatever I felt, backstory, whatever it is that I needed to feel comfortable moving forward. So it was very collaborative. I really appreciated that.
What was the actual recording process like? Was it a lot of mocap? Was it just in the booth? Did you get to do stuff live with your other actors?
Yeah, we did a lot of stuff. So I was in Montreal for almost 2 months, just doing motion capture for all the cinematic scenes, some of the IOPs, invasion of privacies, a couple different things. But and I've been back and forth since, doing more mocap for DLCs and things of that nature. And then outside of that, I also had like a solid, I'd say, 3 weeks in the booth of just recording lines, but you don't record those with the other actors. So it's pretty miraculous when the dialogue actually flows well, because you can't hear what their performance is.
Right.
So it's pretty cool to see that it actually works. But the mocap, we all were in the room together, and I think that really contributed to the dead set camaraderie.
That was your first mocap experience, right? What was that like?
Oh yeah. Well, you got like this helmet on your face. That's the biggest thing. It's like, the suit is one thing. It's like, man, have I been working out enough? Am I embarrassing myself right now walking in this room in this suit? Is everyone staring at me? Look away. But eventually you get over that. But the helmets are the tough thing, because
yeah,
you've got to act with someone who also has a helmet on. And when you're doing a, not to say an intimate scene, but in proximity, because there were no intimate scenes in Watch Dogs 2 for Marcus.
Well, some of the invasions of privacies, though, I don't spoil anything, but they...
Yeah, right, exactly. You've got those. But just in terms of like being close to another actor, mm-hmm, it took a while for us to get used to our depth perception with these helmets, because we would knock into each other all the time and be like, can we cut? Can we cut? Because I blinked really hard because I thought I was about to die.
This is like a little inside basketball knowledge. I was hanging out with the guys that make the 2K game, NBA 2K, And it's a similar thing with the mocap. You know, there's always these scenes in the my player portion of the game where, you know, you might be shooting hoops with your high school coach. And because of the helmets, the arc on dude's shots is always just bizarre. If you really watch it, like, they're holding the ball, like, really high over their head, and it takes some getting used to.
The crazy thing was, I like to call it, like, the Denzel Washington stare. If you look at a lot of Denzel Washington movies, I love it because I even try to do it sometimes. It's very powerful. He'll very rarely tilt his head up when he talks to someone. He kind of like keeps his head tilted down, even if they might be taller than him. It's like he's talking down to you when you could be, you know, 6'7". But that gives you all the power in the world. And so it's very powerful. But I felt like the helmets forced me into that because I had to look over this bar. So I was constantly talking down like Denzel, which, you know, to me is one of the he's one of the smoothest guys in the world. I don't think Marcus came off that smooth, but if there's ever a moment where I wanted to be Denzel Washington, I was doing it right then and there.
And how well did all the capture stuff transfer, in your opinion? I mean, obviously your voice is your voice, but when you're looking at the face and the walk and the running and all the motions, is it like looking in a mirror, or is it like kind of an uncanny valley version of you?
Well, Marcus, I think, you know, they had it down to like a science. He's like 80% me. Mm-hmm. And then they take like other features and change things around. And I'm like, so it's kind of trippy watching someone who, I think the movements are very accurate. Even the facial expressions are pretty accurate, even though I like to think sometimes I'm more expressive. But I was like, man, that's all I did there? Trying to think back to my performance. But, you know, I think it was very accurate in terms of everything that it captured. I think the technology is super efficient, but it's just weird looking at someone who's very similar to you, but not you. It's been a fun journey. I was watching some of the cutscenes. I was showing my mother some of the cutscenes the other night because I'm home right now for the holidays. And she was like, oh, this is what you did, but that's not you. I was like... Yeah, Mom, you know, video games deal with likeness. You know, they have this whole likeness thing. It can't be 100% you, but it kind of looks like me. And she's like, yeah, but it's not.
So, you know, so such a classic mom comment. Such a like lack of positive reinforcement. That is exactly what my mom would say.
It's like, Mom, either you are really proud of me, or like I don't know what else to tell you. This is what we did. No, but hold on. Don't get me wrong. My mother's very happy. Very proud. But yeah, I think she was just taken aback, like, but it doesn't look like you. You did all this stuff and it's not exactly you. But no, I think, you know, the technology they have is so efficient. The crazy thing is I worked on a pilot this year, and one of my buddies on the pilot, he played Michelangelo in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies, the new ones. And so he was showing pictures of their mocap suits, and they could shoot it outside, which is like, They actually have a mocap shell and everything, which is pretty cool to see, man. So like, that's my next goal, is to be a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle.
So you spent months playing this character. So you mentioned being able to throw in some bits of your own history or just your own suggestions. So what kind of stuff could you incorporate into the character? Could you just ad lib, or how closely were you bound to the script?
I mean, in terms of plot, I definitely couldn't change any of the plot or storyline. But in terms of just vocabulary, like, I didn't do it too often, but I know, like, in the Bay, they say, or in California, they say hella.
Yeah.
Hella, like, hella cool, you know, whatever. I would try to throw that in, and you know, the writers would be like, is that what is that? You know, some of the writers would ask, because we'd always have a writer on in the what they call the volume that day. And so, you know, they were always there to check, and we'd check and be like, hey, is it cool if I say this instead of this? But they were very free, just mostly, it was mostly colloquialisms, you know, slang per se, that they let me just run rampant with. And I ended up cursing a lot too, for no reason. But, you know, to me, I think it worked. So
how soon in the process did you get to, like, play yourself? Did you get to see what it was going to look like as a finished product?
Oh, late, way, way late. Only thing I got to see was that. So basically the suits have those sensors on them, and then they take them up to a lab where they look at just your data points, just your movement. And that's the only thing I got to see. Like, I could see a scene acted out through my points. Like, these points are Marcus, and these points are Wrench, and watch the scene happen that way. But I didn't get to see a final render of of any scene until maybe a couple weeks before the game came out. One of the directors of the mocap had the game, the beta. And so I got to play it. And that was the first time I saw any of the game rendered. So it was quite a long time. That was maybe July. And we started in January.
And so you mentioned the sort of mixed reviews for the first one, and the second one got much better reviews. The consensus was that it was a really good game, and I agree. And is there any way for you to sense that as you're working on the game? Or are you just kind of reading your lines and doing the best you can do with your part and just hoping everything else that is out of your control comes together?
I think we definitely felt, the cast and I think we all felt like we really had a genuine connection. We would hang out of work, you know, and I think that contributed to the relationships that showed throughout the game. And with that being said, I think we definitely felt we had the right energy. We also had John Tinch, who plays T-Bone, who was a part of the first game. And John, you know, he was just telling us the energy that we had was in the right vein. And he felt like this was going to be a positive step forward for the franchise, just from his experience with the first game to the second one. So that was really all we had to ride on. And of course, the directors who helped out with the first game and were in charge of this game and were able to tell us, no, this is like the way we're shooting this, or the way this is written is going to move the story along and change the tone of the piece of the franchise itself. So they were very positive in their reinforcement, but there was no way to tell how it would turn out. Because essentially, if the mechanics of the game aren't good, nobody really cares about the acting or the story.
Right.
So I think they did a great job in listening to the fans and you know, changing some of the things that fans wanted to see, upgrading the driving. And I think the mechanics, the hacking, some of the hacking options were upgraded as well. So it was a lot of fun to see the final product.
Have you gotten any, like, obviously Justin waited a while before telling us, oh yeah, by the way, my cousin is in Watch Dogs 2. have you gotten any reactions from people that you know that had no idea that you were in this game, and then all of a sudden they play this game and they're like, wait, that voice sounds familiar?
No.
Because you told everyone you know.
Yeah, you told everybody.
I told everyone. And I just want to point out, Justin is the second family member who's just not all that impressed with what I'm doing.
That is not, no.
Justin is the hater, though.
That's not true. No, because no, I just haven't gotten a chance to play, and I want to play with Ruffin when I do play, ideally.
I don't know if I could take that criticism.
Listen, I've never been critical in my life.
No, but I told everyone.
Yeah.
I was so excited. And like, also, you know, you start doing like voiceover for like the TV spot that ran before Christmas and stuff, yeah, or right before the game came out. And so when I got to see the TV spot, I was even more excited. And all the trailers that were coming out, I was like, this thing looks real. And, you know, it's hard to believe that I was a part of this process. But no, you know, I definitely think this is by far the biggest credit that I have so far. So, you know, as you said earlier, looking at the credits on IMDb, you know, I've done a couple episodes here and there. And I did shoot a pilot this year, which was great, but it didn't get picked up by NBC. But that was my first time playing a series regular on a TV show. So with that and the video game, I was like, everyone needs to know. Everyone. So everyone knew beforehand.
But real quick, so like, speaking of people recognizing you, like, can you talk about the fan art? Because I keep going to your Twitter feed and seeing that the likeness of Marcus Holloway all over your feed from people who have drawn stuff or memed stuff. I don't know how I'd react to that if, like, people were taking this character that, again, like you said, looks mostly like me, but it's a different person, but it's kind of the same person. And they made art as, like, in tribute to me, man. What is that?
I'm drawing
like
a picture of you right now, Charity.
Oh, my God. He's actually doing this, too. He's not even running.
You know, it's the fans are really wonderful. I love the fan art, but the thing that really blew my mind was, like, right after the game was announced at E3's, what I saw was some of the developers were going to different gaming conferences all across the world. So I think they went to Germany, and there were people dressing up as Marcus, like, literally 3-4 days later after E3's. Right. That blew my mind. The fans with this game have been so loving and like, just positive. I think the cool thing is, I'd say every week I probably get at a minimum 5 or 6 people that just write, hey, I just finished the game, I loved your performance. And, you know, that makes it completely worth, like, the entire experience. And to see the level of artistry, like, I think these people need to be designing games, need to be doing graphics. Like, they're so, the art that they create is top notch. So the fans have just been great, man. It was a little overwhelming at first, but then you see your Twitter followers going up and you're like, oh, this is kind of cool. Maybe I can get verified.
Is that that's your end game with all of this, is to get
verified? That's my end game. So Justin, if you know the way.
I mean, listen.
Make the calls, call the proper channels.
We'll make it happen.
Listen, oh yeah, my other question, is your younger brother done any Marcus Holloway fan art or cosplay? That's the real. Has that happened yet? Or has he played the game?
He does own the game, but my brother, his name's Landon, and he is obsessed with the idea that Marcus has a younger brother named Darnell Holloway. And I don't know. So he keeps telling me to tell Ubisoft that if there's any room for Darnell to make a couple cameos in some DLC stuff, that he's ready. Willing.
Darnell Holloway is the most R&B name I've ever heard in my life.
That's what he can bring to the game. He can bring some good tunes.
Yeah.
Some live tunes.
Yeah, I'm looking at your Twitter feed right now, and the DedSec branding is really cool. Like, the logo stuff they did in the game is just really compelling. Also, kind of like a really underrated part of this game is the clothes are pretty dope. Did you know anything about the look at all? Did you have any input on that, or is it just like you saw the finished product? Because it's like the look of the characters is very distinctive and really cool.
So, you know, they had like basic character renderings when I got there. So the way you see Marcus on the posters, they might have changed a couple of details since the beginning, but that's been the generic. That's what they want Marcus to look like to sell. And then they told me about halfway through that they were going to have all these clothing options. And I didn't understand until I played the game. But it's almost limitless. There are so many options. You can make him look as cool or as weird, or he can go around in boxers all day if you want. You know, like, it's pretty miraculous what they did with to allow the player to have complete control over how they want to move through this world and how they see Marcus. I think it's really innovative. It's a lot of fun.
The FYI for the fan artist, though, is that the real Ruffin wears cream sweaters and turtlenecks. So that's just for all the deviant art pages. That's the artist guidance that I will drop on this podcast.
And also sings R&B songs.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you think you play the game differently because the avatar is 80% you? Like, when I'm playing, I take some crazy risks with this character because you can play in all kinds of different ways. You can play stealth. You can just kind of do run and gun. Do you play more conservatively because you don't want to see yourself die?
Yes, for sure. And, you know, like, anybody who's got the game and been like, hey, man, I'm about to open this up, I'm like, please don't kill me too much. Please don't do it. but like the cool thing is, I had this conversation with one of my Twitter fans, one of the DedSec, I call them DedSec members. One of my DedSec members on Twitter tweeted me about what was my favorite mission. And I think, what did I say? I probably said New Dawn at the time because I had just finished playing it. But we talked about how we did it differently. And I was telling them I didn't use my gun until something tragic happened in the game. I don't know if you guys played it all the way through, but no spoilers. Something tragic happens. But because of how I felt shooting the cinematic scenes related to that mission, that was the only time I felt necessary to go out and like murder people.
Wow.
but outside of that, I definitely played it all stealth. But all of that's based on like my character development and what I did in preparation for the role and how I viewed Marcus. So it's strange to me to know, like, somebody was like, yeah, I've just been running around guns blazing the entire time. I'm like, that's not Marcus, but that's their Marcus, you know? And that's the beautiful thing about video games is that you get to take control. So
yeah. I was going to ask, because you have a demo reel up on IMDb, but there's no Watch Dogs in there yet. So you need to update it. And I'm wondering what you would put in if you had to pick a scene or gameplay video or something to represent your performance.
That's really tough. What would I put in on that? Well, I don't want to give any spoilers, you know. I think there was one scene with Dushan Nimick that I really liked where he kind of has the upper hand. It's in the middle of the game where DedSec kind of has their morale busted, if you will. And I really like that scene. The actor's name is Chris Jacot. Wonderful actor. And I think we had more takes of this scene than any other scene in the game because we did it one way and we thought we had got it. And then maybe a week later, they were like, no, we want to change the tone a little bit. So we were both actually kind of frustrated by the end of shooting it because we were like, what do they want? But eventually, I think the final scene turned out pretty good. So that's maybe one that I would have on there. That's the one where I get to throw a punch. And I wouldn't say I'm a fighter. As Justin said, I wear turtlenecks and sweaters. So I'm not much of a fighter.
Obviously, hacking has been in the air as of late in a variety of ways, whether it be entertainment and politics and life in general. So, I mean, like, I know, you know, obviously everyone communicates by email, but I know so many people now who, you know, when you use email, you are basically writing something that you are aware that it will somehow come out at some point. Sure. You know, you just have that in the back of your mind. How has Watch Dogs been involved in this process, and then watching, you know, the various things that have happened in the news of late, has it altered your the way you think about hacking at all?
Well, I will say this. My immediate fear was like, some hacker who plays this game is going to want to hack me. I was instantly like, just thinking about the game coming out, I was like, well, that would make sense, but I pray it doesn't happen. But it has kind of changed in terms of privacy. Like in preparation for the role, I watched a couple things. There was a documentary about Anonymous that I watched. And, you know, of course, they do things for the lulls. They're trolling a lot of times. But when it gets down to, like, really in terms of the government's range of what they can do, in my research, and especially I watched like an interview on Edward Snowden and like what he put out, which either you feel he did a justice or he's a traitor. I don't think there's any gray in between. But what you do see is that the potential reach of the government is far and vast. And so I think the game dealing with that really has kind of at least opened my lenses to be like, oh, these are things that I should be conscious of. Thus, I don't think I'll buy an Amazon Echo. I think that's what it's called. or the I don't know what the Google one is called, but I'm like, these things have to be sending information right back to Google and Amazon. Like
Ruffin, you sound like Will Smith at the end of Enemy of the State right now. I'm talking about yeah. Who are the watchers?
You
got to
put your cell phone in a bag of in a bag of potato chips.
Yeah,
that's right. To block the transmitters. Yeah. I built these. Gene Hackman's with me.
You have something they want.
So a lot of the conversation surrounding Watch Dogs 2 obviously had to do with issues of representation and diversity in video games, and it's an incredibly diverse cast, and historically there's been a big lack in video games of characters who look like a lot of the people who have historically played video games, which is a problem and seems to slowly be correcting itself, but there are still relatively few high profile, big budget releases that kind of go out of their way to rectify that in the way that it seems Watch Dogs 2 does. So was that important to you? Have you heard from a lot of fans about whether that was important to them?
Absolutely. You know, the cool thing was I'm going to forget this guy's name and forgive me, my friend. But he reached out to me. He's a student at Stanford and he's studying computer programming. And he wants to work in Silicon Valley. And I had read an article about the lack of diversity in Silicon Valley right before shooting the game. And so when he saw the game come out, he reached out to me and just said how cool it was to see a representation of someone that was close to him. And essentially, you know, and the crazy thing is when the game was announced, I tried not to read too much into it, but there were some chat rooms and stuff where people were like, No black hacker lives in San Francisco, and this isn't believable based on population numbers and things of that nature. And to me, it's like all it takes is one person to tell a story, even if the numbers don't suggest it. All it takes is one person to represent that to tell the story. And so I've had fans reach out and just say how important it is to see someone that looks like them or someone that represents, you know, even with the character Josh, who's dealing with autism. He has Asperger's. Even Josh, you know, characters, fans are reaching out to him, to the guy that played him. His name's Jonathan Dubsky, and just telling him how important that character is to them, to see someone represented in, you know, this gaming world that they love so much, but to finally see someone that's like them. And so I think Watch Dogs 2 did a great job with opening the spectrum. And of course, this year, you know, Mafia 3 came out with another diverse protagonist. So, you know, it's interesting to see where gaming's going, and it's just becoming more universal, I think.
Mm-hmm. So lastly, this big role kind of fell into your lap, and it sounds like it's been a great experience. So are you hoping career-wise that this is a springboard to more TV/movie roles, or would you be totally content if you just became primarily a video game voice actor and just kind of went from game to game?
I think I want to do both. The cool thing about the fans of video games from video games is that, they're the most passionate of any fans in entertainment. And that's because they literally sit down every day and play hours upon hours and listen to hours upon hours of your voice and performance and take control of that. And so with that, there's an ownership that happens with video game fans and that I love. And so like this community, I call the Dead Set community, they feel like family. And so I got to give a big shout out to the fans. So I would love to continue to do video games. And, if Watch Dogs wants to bring Marcus back, I'm not opposed. But we'll see what happens. But of course, I also, I got my training at Rutgers University. I got my master's there, and I grew up watching movies and television, and my training's in theater. So, if in any way this can affect my career, I want it to affect all lanes and just make more things possible. Of course, I want to be, on your TV screen, on the movie screen. And then when you get home, you can play some Watch Dogs. And that would be awesome, man. It'd be the awesome combination of goals to be reached.
Ruffin, if I could ask one more embarrassing family related question. Yes or no? Did you audition for the forthcoming Power Rangers movie? That's all I want to know. Did you audition for Power Rangers?
I think I'm too old, man. They wouldn't let me in.
But you got muscles and stuff. Oh, come on, man.
Yeah,
you're
but
fit.
So unlike Marcus, I can't do all the flips. Like they brought some other guys in. These guys, like the stunt guys that worked on Watch Dogs 2, are legit ninjas. Legit. Like they will throw a smoke screen down and disappear in a second. And I'm like, how did you disappear in that tight mocap suit? But they are the things that they could do and the way that they could pick up the fighting choreography and the parkour so fast. It was mind blowing. So all that to say, I don't think I could do the flips and things that are required by a Power Ranger. But if Zordon calls, I'm going.
I've literally flipped you before. You can flip. I believe in you, Robin.
Well, if how about this? If Power Rangers call, I'm just going to have a writer in my contract that says I need Justin Charity. to flip me in all flip scenes.
I'm there for
you.
And
we can put you in like a green screen suit so like no one can see. You'll just like disappear into the background. Does that work for you?
For sure.
I was listening to the podcast about video games turned movies.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was very fun.
Thanks.
Very fun. I was thinking, I was like, what about Mario Brothers? And then you guys brought it up. It's not perfect, but it's a lot of fun.
Fun in a bad way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, man. That's a tough category. It's a tough, tough category.
Tough. Yeah. Very tough.
A lot of losses in that category. I think they announced at E3s that Watch Dogs 2 is the next Ubisoft series that they want to do that to.
Hey, here we go.
Or not Watch Dogs 2, but Watch Dogs, the franchise. So we'll see.
What's up? Are you going to be the lead? Can we yeah. break news right now?
Yeah, right. I got to be Michael B. Jordan or something, man.
Oh, man.
All right. Everyone can find Ruffin on Twitter at rprentice3. That's Roman numerals. Help him get verified. Thanks for coming on, Ruffin.
Thanks, hey, a lot,
thanks for having me. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
And Justin, thanks for the hookup.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, so that is it for this episode. It's a little harder to plan ahead these days since we can't look at the calendar and see a gigantic, big-budget AAA release every week. So we're going to get a little more creative. We're heading into the part of the calendar where we can talk about some indie stuff or talk about some gaming subcultures and have some interesting people on. So we don't know what we'll be doing next week, but we'll find something to talk about. There's always something.
We can just talk about Hitman and ways that you can hide bodies when you are discovered murdering someone
yeah,
in the back of a fashion show.
I think that's going to be next for me. All right. So we will be back, same place, same day next week. Talk to you then.
See ya.